Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, Earth Explorers, all around, above and beneath planet Earth. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Glad to be here tonight with you. Last week we had a lot going on, so we ran an archive. I hope you enjoyed it. Next week, we will be at the getting ready for the eSETI conference in Washington State up at Trout Lake. Those of you that haven't made plans to get away this summer, now's the time. This is one of the rare treats of the year, is to be able to go up, sit at the base of Mount Adams, and hear some of the best speakers, the best presenters from around the world on various paranormal subjects. If you want to be part of tonight's program, you can always call in. All you have to do is reach a cell phone tower, 415-762-1161, anywhere on planet or off planet. 415-762-1161. Tonight at 6 p.m. Pacific, an hour after we began tonight, we have the author of Universe Solved, Jim Elvidge, coming on. Great book. If you have a chance to pick it up, we want you to do so. After you listen to the interview, you'll probably want to pick it up. He's very clever and has really put together quite a study on the mystery and matrix of reality on the Earth. And I think you'll enjoy it, and I definitely think you'll enjoy the interview. As our listeners begin to pile on from around the planet, this hour, because it is Father's Day, those of you that are listening to this as an archive, you might try listening live sometime, because we have the craziest things happen here, and we're going to cover some subject material from a point of view you may not be familiar with. The solar wind tonight is a comfortable 381.7 kilometers per second, and the proton count is less than one. So if you're thinking about getting outside and getting a tan, today would be the day. Sunspot 1082 is barely noticeable and does not pose any threats for flares, but that isn't the big news from the sun. The magnetic eruption today, the largest of the year, is what was really interesting. It was spectacular, caught by the Solar Dynamics Observatory. If you don't know what I'm talking about, it's because you don't listen to this program very often. You should go to the SDO website. You can always find a link to it somewhere on X Squared Radio. This is a remarkable new observatory that takes 3D pictures of the sun right down in the neighborhood. So we can see magnetic currents right down on the surface of the sun that we've never been able to see before, and that gives us clues as to what's going on beneath the surface. That's very significant for tonight's program and for your observation and continuance on planet Earth, so to speak. There were 27 earthquakes over the last 24 hours, over 3.0 on the Richter scale, and only two were over 5. None were over 6. All seems to be quiet on planet Earth. News, however, from the moon. The moon's interior may harbor 100 times more water than previous estimates, according to a new study that took a fresh look at samples of moon rocks collected by Apollo astronauts nearly 40 years ago. You thought no one was looking at that stuff anymore, but they are. And coupled with data which they obtained during the recent bombing of the moon, those of you that missed that episode, go back to October of last year when NASA launched a rock, so to speak, dropped a heavy projectile onto the moon and watched it splatter up the surface of the moon, and caught that splatter with various spectrometers. Coupling that information, that spectral information, with a re-examination of the moon rocks, and what they have found is that there's a veritable ocean underneath the surface of the moon. Now, why in the world we haven't gone back to the moon since the early 70s is beyond me. I don't know about you, but you probably didn't even know what a computer was in the early 70s. Those of us that were working with them in the mid-60s remember that they used 2-inch wide tape on big reels, and we used wonderfully fast and problem-free data entry systems like punch cards. Yes, punch cards. And that's how we wrote programs. So you bought computer time at the beginning of the semester for a couple of dollars, actually, because it didn't take but a few seconds to run your program. And the idea was to run the program without any errors, let alone to write an actual program that did something besides add a couple of columns of numbers. Computers have come so far that it boggles my mind, and I know it boggles your mind, why we have not been back to our nearest neighbor. If it has unlimited potential as a source of H3, which is a great and clean and renewable power source, or maybe not renewable, but it's certainly clean burning, and now we have a plethora of water. With power and water, we can make our own environment there inside of living quarters, which we might construct on the surface of, or, as I highly recommend, under the surface of the moon, thus out of the way of salt grain-sized meteorites that so freely hit the surface up there and would just ruin your day if you were out picking roses. The researchers determined that lunar water likely originated early in the moon's formation history, suggesting that it is, in fact, native to the moon. And it also could be the occasional cometary tail that the Earth and the moon have passed through from time to time. Scientists have also found evidence that there is life on Saturn's biggest moon, Titan. No, it's not just in the movies. They have discovered clues that primitive aliens are breathing. Yes, breathing, respirating, inhaling, exhaling, living in Titan's atmosphere and feeding on fuel at the surface. Data from NASA's Cassini probe has analyzed the complex chemistry on the surface of Titan, the only moon known to have a dense atmosphere. Its surface is covered with mountains, lakes, and rivers, which has led astronomers to call it the most Earth-like world in the solar system. Organic chemicals had already been detected on the 3,200-mile-wide planet. That's just a skunch under half the size of Earth. But the liquid on Titan is not water. No, it's methane. And the scientists expect life there to be methane-based. Good old CH3, carbon-based life, respirating the other way. Methane to us, besides being rather annoying at the dinner table, is toxic in high enough concentrations. Methanol can cause a heart attack in some and nerve damage in high enough concentrations. And methane, of course, a contributor to greenhouse effects here on the Earth, many, many more times than carbon dioxide, is trapped in virtual oceans underneath the oceans of our planet. Under intense pressure and cold, the methane stays liquid, at the bottom of the sea, should the oceans warm enough to allow methane to boil at that pressure, we would be in trouble, and the beings on Titan would be right at home. Don't forget, Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, is out as an ebook, and you can pick it up at rememberingthefuturebook.com. Rememberingthefuturebook.com. The physical copy of Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, is through editing. What we're doing right now with the publisher is working through the print-ready PDF, which will go to the printer. Once it goes to the printer and the galley copy is approved, we expect that to happen early next month. It will go live on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, everywhere else. And then we will begin our interview schedule, and you will be able to get your hard copy autographed if you buy it from our website, if you buy it from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, online booksellers everywhere. It won't come autographed, but it may come expeditiously. This book is just about 200 pages. It's designed that way, not my normal 500-page book, because I wanted to get a message across as concisely and inspirationally as I could. And so that is the nature of this book. And if you have read the ebook, a couple hundred of you out there have ordered it and read it. And if you have a review on it, I would most appreciate it if you would send it to me. I've had a couple of reviews, some small things, and I have made edits to the book because I wanted to make sure that that point or certain points got away clearly into your mind so that they can have the desired effect. Anyway, it's on sale as an ebook, $7.95. And remember that I will send you a coupon which will allow you to buy the book for 25% off from our website, and you'll get it in hard copy, autographed, and I may actually have the audio book by that time. So if I do, I will send that to you as well. So for $7.95, you get the autographed version, 25% off, and the audio book as soon as it's finished. As you know, many things going on in the private life of Brooks Agnew. The car company, Vision Motor Cars, is working its way forward. You know that there were a lot of splishing and splashing and foaming at the mouth in the electric car business over the last, oh, I'd say 2 years pretty well. The last year it has become a frenzy of about 24 little companies out there. Some of them publicly traded, some of them not. I would say most of them publicly traded, some of them not. And it has been a real struggle to get access to capital for all of us. While we collectively would probably hire about 40 to 60,000 new workers, many of whom are out of work, and all of that money would be used at the rural level, that is to say small business, many of us would employ between 500 and 1,500 employees. But this is exactly the kind of employment that the nation needs right now. And as you know, the federal government has other designs. They want to keep the giants in business and are not letting us into the game. So now that that has been discovered, by all of us, and I'm going to throw all of us in there, the Fiskers, the Brights, the Fixes, the Vision Motor Cars, the Codas, the rest of us, even though some of the suppliers that make batteries and motors and various components to the electric vehicles did manage to get grants. Those grants have long since been exhausted because there are no electric cars on the market yet. So without anybody buying cars, there's obviously nobody buying motors and nobody buying batteries or battery separators or cables or generators or anything else that has to do with electric vehicles. And so the entire industry, all the way down the supply chain, is struggling. And some of them have not survived. I think we recently heard that Phoenix Motors, although they had a couple of very nice designs, a little heavy, but, you know, nice designs, and certainly would have made some fine vehicles for people, is no longer with us. And that is a shame. That is a real shame, because that's where the real innovation comes. That's where the drivers to this industry, so to speak, are coming from. And, you know, those of you that believe the press out there that something is being done to support the electric vehicle business, and I think those of you that heard Obama's speech recently really needed to pay attention to John Stewart's response to the speech, because it was nothing short of brilliant, absolute genius, and funny as hell. And I got to tell you, going back 8 presidents, you could take the script from all of them, going all the way back to Jimmy Carter, and play it, and it would have laced nicely and just as ineffectually into Obama's speech the other day. In short, it's all talk, no action. Or as we say in the South, we hear a lot of clucking, but we don't see any eggs. So the question comes down, and I get this when I go to auto shows. I get it when we take the truck out and we drive pollution-free around the city, or someone calls us up about the vehicle. They ask, you know, how can I get one? When are you guys going to go into production? What's holding the show up here? It's a matter of frustration that it is difficult to get across to you. But we must realize now, after 2 years of dancing with wolves, that the money has to come from the private sector. Yes, it has to come from private investors. It has to come from investors who have the same vision that we do. And that vision is that there is a cure for gasoline. Yes, yes. It's true. I know you think that it was incurable, that it stuck with us for life, that we now have a gasoline gene that we'll never get rid of, but it's true. There is a cure for gasoline. I personally drive a diesel truck. I need it because sometimes I have to haul a couple of vehicles to a car show, 500 miles, and that's not something I can do with an electric vehicle. They do have their uses, but I don't buy gasoline. And I try to grow my own diesel fuel. Not that you all can do that, but that's coming too. The point is that there is a cure for gasoline. And yes, yes, I'm an old gearheader. My goodness, I drag raced motorcycles, I drag raced cars, I road raced. Anything that would drive on gasoline, I loved it. I thrived on it. I liked the sound of an internal combustion engine. But after I got over my withdrawals, you know, that withdrawal symptom where the gear shift is vibrating in your hands as your left leg is pressed firmly against the floor holding the clutch, the only thing separating an angry, hungry engine at the tip of your toes from the back end of your vehicle, and you're about to let it loose. Yes, yes, it's a great feeling. But I can tell you, there is nothing like the torque from an electric motor. And there's nothing quite so satisfying as whipping a Corvette with a toaster. Yeah, it can be done. And believe me, it can be done inexpensively and affordably. And we're going to launch anyway, because private investors have been found, and we're processing it right now, and we're going around the government. So any of you out there who think that you have innovative technology that might help electric vehicles get a great start, or restart, or recharge, fear not, because very soon you'll have a platform to launch that technology. And don't worry about ever getting buried, because that's not going to happen. Those of us that have survived in the electric vehicle business, we know who our friends are, and we damn sure know who our enemies are. And speaking of enemies, Mr. Danoff, a Fort Lauderdale fish farmer who's on the water at least 3 days a week, aimed his 31-foot center console fishy business at the mysterious upright he found in the water. That's right. While he had his boat out on the water, fishing, he saw a mast in the water, except there was no boat under the mast. As he got closer, he found himself eye to eye with a periscope off the coast of Florida. And just as he began to go for his camera, it was off to the races. 20 knots, that periscope took off through the water and eventually went under and was not seen. So he reported it to the Coast Guard, who said they would look into it, and that's been a few days. Nothing has come of it. Sounds like someone is sneaking around in the waters off the coast of Florida, and they aren't from our neighborhood. And don't forget, Twitter is alive and well on X Squared Radio. If you go to xsquaredradio.com, our Twitter transcript is right there on the right. You can see what people are saying. I encourage you to add stuff to it. Add us to your Twitter. Follow us. Retweet our stuff. And let's get it out there. I'll tell you, it's having its effect. It's really having its effect. There are some amazing things that have happened in the news this last week. Those of you that have been following the elections know that there's a gentleman out there who ran for election and did not go make a speech. He didn't get out on the campaign trail. He only used social media, and his candidate was out there knocking on doors, beating the bushes, spending money, and stumping as hard as he could at every microphone that would stand still, and you guessed it, the social media whiz won the election. Sounds like a wave of the future, doesn't it? Maybe it doesn't take millions of dollars to win a congressional seat. Very interesting stuff. And also, I don't want you to forget that to click on the Web Talk Radio link at X Squared Radio. If you go to xsquaredradio.com, there's a Web Talk Radio banner right at the top and over on the right-hand side, because we didn't want you to miss it. This is a short 30-minute version of X Squared Radio. It is free to listen. It isn't live yet. It is a move towards syndication. We absolutely are eternally grateful for BBS Radio, and we always encourage those who feel they have it in them to be a talk radio host to get a hold of me, and I will contact the owners of BBS Radio and help sponsor you, help get you in so that you can become your own talk radio host. If you've got what it takes, if you can sit behind this microphone week after week, tell your story, and better yet, get people wanting to sit down and listen to your story. BBS Radio is, I think, for my money, the best place on the planet to get your start. The love at this network is beyond measure and has changed me, and thus has allowed me to speak to you all, and I appreciate it more than you know. The Web Talk Radio is a syndicated run. That is to say, we are trying to get the rest of the world interested in what you are already interested in, and that is the mysteries of the universe and of the earth, commented on not by a professional broadcaster, but by a professional scientist who happens to like sitting behind a microphone from time to time. We can answer the questions, and we can interpret the interpretable for you. And even the uninterpretable, if it is a mystery, we can at least delve into it from an intelligent point of view, often humorous and definitely passionate, and let you know how to understand it. And that's why people listen to this program. And that's why we think that the syndicated run, this is a forum, a theater, as it were, where X Squared Radio can get listened to by people who would normally listen to only broadcast radio. If it is as appealing to them as it is to you, then X Squared Radio will join other great late-night talk radio programs around the country, and people will then have a choice. And that's what we're shooting for. So if you have an opinion on that, if you read the book, or you have anything to add to our program tonight, you are always welcome here. We'll talk about anything you want to talk about. 415-762-1161. 415-762-1161. And I'm greatly appreciative of the new listeners in Prague, many of whom have purchased the Ark of Millions of Years series. This was the first three books that E.J. Clark and I produced from 2004 to 2006. It's about 1,500 pages. Forward Magazine calls it the most comprehensive work ever done on the 2012 end times. And I had a reader just the other day call me up, and he was about halfway through volume three of the book, and he said, "Listen, if this doom and gloom goes on, I don't know if I can finish the book." And I said, "Hang in there, because the last part of volume three offers the hope." We just couldn't finish the book as a series of nothing but doom and gloom. So there is a bright light at the end of the tunnel, and it is the precursor, the foundation for Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, which I just finished, and which you can pick up the ebook of right now and the hard copy very, very soon, about, I would say, 5 to 6 weeks if the publisher is true to form. And that's a great story. It's a lot of work, and it will bring you up to date, because we're all ready to 2010, and believe me, you have some preparations to make. One of our friends and associates, Paul Faust, is the founder of 1-800-PREPARE.com, 1-800-PREPARE.com. If you have any thoughts at all about getting prepared, I don't care if it's dehydrated food, if it's a water filter, if it's a day pack, or if it's a 25-year food supply for you and your family. And I'm not talking about one that weighs so much that you have to leave it behind when the disaster hits. And believe me, the disaster is going to hit. These are lightweight, packaged, and ready to go. We have searched dozens and dozens of preparedness companies. This one was founded by an EMT, a firefighter, and emergency preparedness specialists, not by people just wanting to make money off of products. These guys have a passion. They have a mission. And their website is called 1-800-PREPARE.com. We need you to stick around. So I would go to that website. Believe me, there is something in that budget for you. A 72-hour kit can be bought for less than $25. $25 makes the difference between you being a burden on the FEMA and emergency rescue teams that come into your neighborhood after the winds go through, after the floods go through, after the snowstorm hits, after the power goes out, and you being able to walk through that with your head held high and maybe be in a position to help someone else. That's the difference. That's the difference. 1-800-PREPARE.com. Please go visit my friend Paul Faust and pick up some preparedness gear from him. Today is a day when we fathers are celebrated. As awkward as it might seem when you think about it, it's quite an honor. The rest of the year, we are asked for money, we solve problems, we work late, we work 40 or 50 or 60 or 100 hours at work, and then we come home, and we're dads, and we go on camping trips, and we fix cars, and we put chains back on bicycles, and all those wonderful things. And today was our day to relax and to be loved. And I would like to extend and reflect that love back to all of you. To come here to this world and have the opportunity to create life in our own image is a privilege afforded God Himself. And in that respect, we are handed awesome power. Not to destroy, not to cause heartache, not to instill fear or to lead by unrighteous dominion. We are handed that power to create life. And that life is born and looks up at us and emulates us, and for good or for ill will likely follow in our footsteps. And as we interview some of the best speakers, scientists, and knowledgeable people on the planet about the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth, part of those mysteries have to do with the effect that your consciousness, your behavior, your leadership, your ability to be a sovereign being and command your own self, to be a master of your own consciousness, passes on to your progeny. You thought that it was all in the genes? Yeah, well, it's kind of nice to look at the genes from time to time. But the genetics are only part of the story, my friends. How you are a father also affects the children of your children. It affects the future. It affects the planet. And as we become better and better at that responsibility, that duty, that wonderful honor, the human race itself evolves. Not without mothers, of course, but that was last month. We're talking about us tonight. This month, this day, we celebrate fathers. And I want you to, if you have not done a good job of this yourself, believe me, it's never too late. Never too late. I was a scoutmaster for 6 years. I had 18 boys. 14 of them had no dads at home. So I was the dad to my two boys, and I was the dad to 14 other boys. And I can tell you, it makes a big difference. I'll tell you when you see it. It's when those boys grow up and they step in and they become the mature leaders that they were born to be, that they were trained to be, that they have the skill set inside of them to be. And you get to hear them speak before a crowd. And the thing that makes you feel great inside is when they say, I still remember my scoutmaster. Sometimes I wouldn't listen to my own mom, but I listened to my scoutmaster, and the things that he taught me have made me the person that I am today. That's the kind of gift that you can hand along, whether you're the biological father or whether you're just the dad. And believe me, when I say this, I think dad is the promotion. Father's the kind of biological reaction, a simple hormonal choice between two cells to create physical progeny. But the promotion is the rank of dad. So serve it well, because each one of those kids is a medal, and it goes on because they take what you taught them, what you gave them, and they take it to their children, your grandchildren, and on and on. And I'm privileged to have 6 grandchildren. No, I'm not that old. 6 grandchildren, and they're all wonderful. And I love them all, and I love you all. And I'm glad you're here tonight with me. If you want to be part of the program, or if you have a Father's Day story, or a special handcrafted whatever that was given to you today, you might want to talk about it. 415-762-1161. We have Jim Elvidge coming on in about half an hour. His book is The Universe Solved, just to give you a little flavor of what is coming up. Did you know that it is impossible to tell the difference between the past and implanted memories? That's true. And those of you that are reveling in how wonderful it is to see 3D movies coming out, and some of them you're wondering, gosh, why did they spend the money to make this one 3D? Did you know that we are only 30 years away from technologies that could completely fool us through implanted memories and full-scale total immersion reality simulations? Yeah, we're getting there. We're getting there. And who's to say we aren't already being fooled by a reality? And, of course, you have to ask the question, if it was programmed, how did it get programmed? Who programmed it? Why did they program it? And, hey, what's going on here? Yeah, we're going to go into all that. The Universe Solved, Jim Elvidge, in about half an hour. Some of the neat things happening in the news right now are affecting the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. One of those we discussed pretty well in depth, myself and John Elinoff. John Elinoff has come on this program before for updates from time to time. His website is, he has a film out called Core of Corruption. And NewWorldOrderReport.com, NewWorldOrderReport.com is John Elinoff's website. He has been off the air for a while. He is getting ready to come back on. You know, and I know, it takes a lot of effort, a lot of planning to put together a program and get back on the airwaves. It takes money, it takes planning, it takes dedication. And he is getting around to getting that back on the air for us. But he is an investigative reporter that has done a really good job putting together some discoveries which sent a chill up my spine. And so I called him up and we talked about it. And I have to tell you that there is some evidence I'm going to give you here in the next 10 minutes that will you're going to scratch your head about it, and then you're going to say, what the is going on here? I mean, what kind of games are these powerful people playing? You know, in the press, we've had the Bilderbergs meeting in Greece, and even last year's meeting wasn't so secret. Some of the items that they spoke about, I'm sure, were in our best interest. I'm winking here in case you can't see it. But interestingly enough, some of the members of the Bilderberg meetings were the CEO of BP and the CEO of Goldman Sachs, and also the owners of Deepwater Horizon. Oh, Deepwater Horizon's not a movie, my friends. It's the rig that's in the Gulf right now, whose connection to the sea bottom was broken and is leaking into our oceans. When in doubt, always follow the money. So let's just track a few things here and see what we can discover. Turns out the CEO of BP sold off a lot of his stock to BP weeks before the accident happened, the disaster. Also, the CEO of Goldman Sachs dumped 44%. Goldman Sachs dumped 44% of their stock in Deepwater Horizon, in BP. The owners of the rig, whose name is Transocean, decided to insure that particular rig for twice its value, and paid the premiums. And boy, did it pay off. They made $270 million off of that disaster. And there's more. Several companies sold between 97 and 98% of their stock in BP days before the disaster. A little over a week before the disaster, BP decided to buy a little obscure company called Boots and Coots. Boots and Coots isn't really a valuable company, except that they are experts in and have put out over 30% of the world's well fires. That's right. They cut their teeth in the Gulf War, putting out well fires. They're experts at it. And they were purchased a little over a week before the disaster. So if you follow the money and you look at the posturing, you look at what was spent and what was saved and what was sold, yes, it was a disaster. But maybe it wasn't an accident. And now our ecology is paying for it. Billions of dollars. Deepwater Horizon is worth $2.2 trillion. $2.2 trillion. That's enough to run the United States defense budget for 2 years, paid in full. President Obama put a moratorium on 30 to 33 more exploratory wells, which were already begun in the Gulf of Mexico. By the way, if you go to Google Earth, you can look at the wells that are in the Gulf right off the coast of Louisiana. It's pretty amazing. They have quite a few out there. Quite a few that are have steel hanging a mile in the water, and then they go a mile below the surface to get to the oil. Together, we're talking about $10 trillion worth of oil reserves. Yeah, $10 trillion worth of oil reserves. And after all of this happens, in the midst of it all, you would think that the administration would be deeply embroiled in it, that they would be talking with it, they would be concerned about it, they'd be sending specialists and cabinet members, and, I mean, come on, this is the greatest ecological disaster in our oceans in the history of the world that we know of, other than a volcano eruption in the sea. But, interestingly enough, Obama doesn't make the speech that you would think. No. The speech sounds like asking for two things. One is a cap and trade tax. Cap and trade, for those of you who don't know what it is, I can explain part of it to you right here. It is a tax on carbon emissions. In other words, CO2, methane, ammonia, all kinds of emissions that would come from a plant. Not necessarily ammonia, but solvents and burned off natural gas and carbon dioxide, like from concrete plants and coal-fired power plants, etc. They would pay a tax on that. The money raised from that tax would turn around and be invested into green technologies. That doesn't sound so bad, does it? Except you know and I know that somewhere along the line there'll be a plethora of handling charges, and the money will go nowhere except right into the pockets of the big corporations that support that particular politician. That's the first thing. The second thing is a little ploy known as nationalization. Some of you listening to this program are not old enough to remember this, but in the early 70s, Saudi Arabia and others in the OPEC group decided to nationalize their oil supplies. Now keep in mind, these had been dug since the 40s, since the 30s, by foreign countries in those countries. Billions and billions of dollars worth of steel and technology and labor had been poured into those countries to build wells, to build distribution systems, to build refineries and transport systems. And those countries nationalized all of those assets. And so they fell out of the ownership of those foreign corporations and fell into the ownerships of those local governments. That's called nationalization. Mexico has an oil company called Pemex. Canada has an oil company that it owns all the way, coast to coast, border to border. It's all owned by the Canadian government. Not so in the U.S. yet. President Obama is talking about nationalizing America's oil supplies. In the Gulf alone, as I said, $10 trillion worth of assets that the government could seize and make their own. And then there would just be U.S. oil. All those private owners of oil wells would relinquish their ownership to the government for the good of the nation, I'm sure. So it turns out that this disaster, which now appears not to be an accident at all, was contrived. It was designed, and it may, in fact, be a false flag event, one that will allow or coax the American voter to empower the government, the U.S. government, or whatever government might be in power of the United States at this time, or in the near future, to take control of the nation's oil supplies. It has often been said that we consume 20% of the world's oil supplies, but we only have 2% of those reserves under our own ownership. That may be true. The world's resources are coming to a slow halt. Saudi Arabia's production is down 40%. The output from the Alaska pipeline down almost 70% since it was built. And there has not been a major oil find in the world since 1972. The reserves are there. They're being drilled into. They're being refined as quickly as possible. But a new reserve, a new oil source, has not been found in large enough quantities to set the world's heart at ease since 1972. And as I said at the beginning of the program, there is a cure for gasoline. I've taken it, and I survived. And you can take it too. But I'm afraid it's going to have to be a private effort, you see. I don't believe, and I have lots and lots of reasons for believing this that I would love to discuss with you if you'll call in, 415-762-1161. I have lots of reasons to believe that the major car companies will never deliver an affordable electric vehicle to the American consumer. The only car that even shows hope of reaching the American consumer is the Nissan Leaf, and unfortunately for the buyer, you don't own the charger and you don't own the battery. The only thing you own is the car. And you can't take it anywhere where there isn't a charging grid. So, sad but true, it looks like electric vehicles are out of reach for another 10 years unless the American public decides that they want to go electric. According to the latest Rasmussen poll, in May, 17% of likely car buyers would buy an electric vehicle. However, only 6-8% would definitely make their next purchase an electric vehicle. That's actually down 1-2% from the last time that poll was taken last August. I believe that is because the hype about electric cars is wearing off. People are tired of driving by the restaurant, smelling the steak cooking on the grill, and the doors are still locked. And so the people have lost faith that the major car makers can deliver an affordable car. The only cars that they are seeing on the internet cost between $40,000 and $100,000. That's well out of the reach of the average consumer. It might be a novelty. It might be something to take to a show-off fest, but nobody is going to buy a car that expensive. Nobody. It's going to have to be really, really something special. And by the way, people that are spending that kind of money, they want to own the whole car. So companies like Vision Motor Cars that are planning to release small pickup trucks and cars at around $25,000, which for all intents and purposes are very affordable since you don't have to spend an extra $3,000 to $4,000 a year to put gas in it, they are not in production yet. And they're not in production because of access to capital. And that has largely been because we, like you, took the bait. Come on, they put the grants out there, we applied for them, we did our little jig, we wore our suits and ties, and guess what? Not a penny, not a dime, nothing. It was a waste of effort, it was a waste of our time, and it cost us millions and millions of dollars. Why did it cost us so much money? Oh, you didn't know. Yes, the Department of Energy requires us to pay $75,000 just to apply. That's right, No guarantees, no refunds. $75,000 that you send in with your application. That's why there are no electric cars right now, because they drained millions and millions of dollars out of the electric vehicle bankrolls around the country and left us without any support. And that's the truth. Those are the facts. And a fact is a direct observation. Those of you that listen to this program often enough to know, a fact is a direct observation, and it is scientifically sound. That, and of course, we have the canceled checks to prove it. So, what kind of game is going on here? We're going to find out at the top of the hour. The Universe Solved, author Jim Elvidge is going to join us, and we're going to talk for a couple of hours about this book, The Universe Solved. It's an awesome hardback and well-written. I can tell you, it's not just a compilation. He adds a twist. It is nonfiction. It is not a novel. It is something that is really going to put you on alert, what's going on. And there have been a lot of comments about it, like Renan Bongeri, he's the author of Society, Scientists, and the Spirit. He says, we have recently been inundated by a spate of books on the science-religion controversy. They all confuse science with reductionist materialism and religion with fundamentalism. This book is one of the notable exceptions. Unfortunately, none of the exceptions are receiving the attention of the rich publishers or the mainstream media. This is all in keeping with the modern cultural trend toward oversimplification of every issue. It is his hope that in this book we will reverse the trend. And that's what we do here on X Squared Radio. We start new trends, counter trends, reverse the trends. And we discuss things free and openly here on BBS Radio Network so that you can respond to it globally. We want you to join us, so get your phones ready, 415-762-1161. I know it's Father's Day. It is for me, too. And I got the calls from my kids, and one of my good friends is up listening to the Eagles concert up north and having a ball. We're down here in record heat, the hottest June in 50 years in this state. This last winter, we were wondering if global warming was done. We had 21 days in a row of snow. That's never happened, not since they've been recording life in this country. We've never had 21 days of snow in this part of the country, but we did this time. And that is why we were wondering if we even had global warming going on. And now we're sweltering under over 91 degrees every single day here. Even if it rains, there's no relief. The heat just comes right back mixed with that glorious humidity, which makes it so hard on mammals, because we sweat, and so wonderful for the wilderness, which you have to beat back with a chainsaw and a stick, because we live in the green part of the country that grows spontaneously at leaps and bounds in ways that no safe way to get rid of it all. I can tell you that it's probably the most gorgeous part of the country, I think. I mean, I like Idaho because you look out over the deserts of Idaho, and it's breathtaking. It's absolutely breathtaking because you can see 40 or 50 miles. The sky is constantly changing colors. The mountains are constantly changing colors. And the wind constantly blows. It's just a different kind of planet. It's not the kind of thing that changes over time. It's almost primordial the way that it looks. And then you have the east with its high humidity and green, so green it hurts your eyes to look at it if you come from out west. Life so noisy that at night, if you're camping in it, you hear the cicadas and the insects in the trees. It's just like Eldoran, you know, the world that Luke Skywalker was taken to by Yoda. That's what the south and the east looks like. And then you have the northwest with the mountains and the snow all year round on the mountains and constant activities in the skies by all kinds of things, eagles and UFOs and just tremendous amounts of energy in the earth stored there, frozen in geological records that boggle the mind. And then, of course, the oceans of the earth that are the life of this planet. All of that surrounding us and keeping us in awe. And it appears that although there have been some less than fortuitous emails out there in the global warming crowd, and it looks like there's been some kind of a picture painted of a conspiracy. I even heard our good friend Rush Limbaugh say the other day that the whole global warming hoax has been uncovered, that it isn't happening. The truth is that all of the glaciers of the world are growing. But it also is true that the temperature swings, the extremes of temperature, north to south of the hemispheres of the planet. The geomagnetic relationship between the Earth and the Sun, or the addition of greenhouse gases by mankind to the planet, are causing broader swings in the climate. We're having colder winters and hotter summers. It's almost as if the Earth has tilted a little bit more on its axis. I know it hasn't, but it's almost as if it has, or if there's energy coming from somewhere else. So let's go ahead and talk to Barry from Arizona. Welcome to the program, Barry.
Hi, Brooks. Thank you. With regard to the electric cars, I was just curious as to if you've given any thought to a high current, low voltage scenario where it's more of a magnetic car as opposed to lithium ion based storage.
Yes, we have. We tried the high voltage 480 and 620 volt systems, and we found them to be too dangerous. Not just from the jaws of life point of view, like you get in a fender bender and your doors won't open, and the fireman comes up and sticks the saw in the door, and there's a giant, you know, 500 volt AC spark because the inverter's still on. Not just from that point of view, but a lot of people are nervous about putting a little quarter-watt cell phone up against their heads. Imagine how nervous they're going to be with a 480-volt, three-phase, 180-kilowatt AC motor strapped between their legs for a couple years. So we did opt to go to low voltage, actually relatively low voltage, 144 volts, and we stuck with the DC precisely for that reason. We're concentrating on the magnetics, and we're getting away from those AC fields.
Oh, okay. Well, you're right on track. I think it's just a matter of time before people see the light.
Well, people see the light. We get 50,000 hits a month on the website. People want the vehicles. That's not the problem. The problem is getting the FMVSS certification, which is about $1.5 million process. That allows people to buy the car. I mean, I drive it every day, but I can. I'm the manufacturer. The consumer can't buy it yet.
Unbelievable. It's as bad as FCC auctions. It's unbelievable. But you need a lobbyist.
Boy, don't I. You know, I've actually talked to a couple of them that were introduced to me. Let's see, one was the lobbyist that helped Tesla get his first two infusions of capital, And the other one, I was introduced to him by a person in the asphalt lobby because he didn't have a lot to do since his last highway bill passed. And neither one of those lobbyists wanted to touch the electric car. They just didn't want to do it.
Have you approached some private capital like Bain or Carlyle or any of those clowns?
That's a good word. I have a good stockpile of clown makeup, by the way. No, I haven't talked to those individuals, but, you know, when we first started putting the plan together, we started putting budgets together like all the other car companies were doing, and we found it was coming out around $80 to $120 million to get a car plant started. And then after about a year, we realized that that kind of capital is not available in this country. So we trimmed it down to a pilot plant, and now we're just looking for $12.5 million. So what we did is we maintained ownership of our company, controlling ownership, and then we went to our suppliers, and a lot of these are multi-billion-dollar companies that are operating at a fraction of their normal capacity. So they want business, and they're not getting it from the port. So they have agreed to front the tooling, to stamp out the parts, to do coatings and harnesses and all kinds of things for us, and amortize it over production. That saved probably $60 million right there. But what we still have to do is get through the FMVSS certification. Now, we've crashed three times, and we did fine. We have six crashes to go, and then we have the components, like the windshield, mirrors, lights, brakes, those kinds of things to get checked off and listed through. That's pretty academic, but it's still about $100,000 to get those parts through through the study. And we could be done. In 4 months, we could be finished, and you could be buying the vehicles from our plant if we could get the capital to get through that testing. Now, I will tell you this. As of May of this year, Vision Motor Cars was the only electric car company crash testing electric vehicles. There's a lot out there on the net. There's a lot out there at the car shows, but they haven't been crashed yet, and that's the difference.
Well, yeah, capital, you named it. So, I'm at a loss. Unless you want to give up some of your own ownership, I don't see a way out. You know, you got to...
we have to maintain 51% or our suppliers will not front us the engineering. They've been through that before. A la General Motors. Everybody got stung by GM this last time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I know people personally that got burned by GM, yeah. Anyhow, okay, look forward to the rest of your show.
All right, thanks for calling, Barry. Call back anytime.
Take care. Bye.
All right. We do have a caller on the other line, but I got to take a quick break. So let me get that out of the way, and then we'll come back on with John Elvidge and our caller. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio. Give us about 4 minutes. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. You know, it's not as far-fetched as it seems. Within 30 years, we will be able to create virtual environments indistinguishable from our reality. Within a few more decades, even physical realities will be manufactured. And we are marching toward an inevitable merge with machines. What's more, it is actually impossible to tell whether or not we have already reached that point. An expert in complex computational systems with over 20 years of research in cosmology, quantum mechanics, philosophy, anomalies, and futurism, our guest tonight presents a theory of reality so perfect, so powerful, that it explains all known scientific and cultural anomalies. Why is the universe so perfectly designed to support life and matter? Why does life feel like it is accelerating? Why do people see UFOs? Why is there life after death? The evidence is actually all around us, within us, and present in every decision we make. This discussion tonight may completely change the way you look at your world, your life, your friends and family, and the computer with which you listen to this program. We'll be right back with author Jim Elvidge with the book The Universe Solved. Don't go away. We'll be right back with X Squared Radio. Did you know that it's impossible to tell the difference between reality and illusion? Well, maybe we'll find out right now with our guest, Jim Elvidge. Welcome to the program, Jim.
Thank you very much, Brooks, and thanks for that great introduction. I think that was probably the most grabbing introduction I've ever heard.
Wow, that's good. Well, that's the way we like to do it. Right away, I think we still have a caller on the line from the last hour. John, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
All right. John, you got a real quick question for Jim before we get started? I didn't want to leave you hanging out there too long.
I'm still going, you know, from what you were talking about before. I kind of wish I'd have waited a little bit. But I'll just make a quick comment about your, to do with your guest. I just discovered a software called POV, which is persistence of vision, and it's a 3D program for artists to create scenes. But the basic function is everything comes from the camera or from, you know, the observation point, and it illuminates everything. So it caught my attention. I thought, well, actually, that's probably how real life works. And so all the functions and all the ray tracing and everything in that program, to me, is a metaphor for what actually happens from the mind to experience reality. So I just thought I'd throw that in.
Well, there you have it. That's the exact encapsulation, as usual. We often talk about the human mind being the lens of consciousness. It's more than just
forward.
Go ahead.
It projects forward, and that's simulated by this program called POV, and it's all based on that. And I thought, how remarkable! This is actually a metaphor for the way consciousness actually works.
Well, you know, Jim has a remarkable quote, and I want to say in his book, he said, Occam never said that the simpler theory was better, just that it might tend
really?
To be. So that's what we're going to discuss tonight, and I want to get Jim on, and we'll talk about that in depth. John, I really appreciate the phone call.
Okay.
Way to start us off. All right, Jim. Hey, gosh. You know, when the movie The Matrix first came out, it was such a mind blower that he really couldn't tell the difference between reality and the program. I loved it when Lawrence Fishburne said, "Is that really air that you're breathing?"
Right.
That's where that's where The Matrix really started to make sense for me.
Yeah, it was really a great kind of depiction of the simulation theory, and it certainly didn't have its origins there. Philip K. Dick had explored that idea in some of his science fiction books. Some physicists have considered it. Philosophers have considered it. I think it was a Chinese philosopher from times of B.C. who said, is it possible that I'm dreaming now and that all my perceptions are false? So, a lot of people have actually thought about, the nature of our reality and, whether we're actually in which state is more real, this or a dream state, or could we be in some sort of, alternative state, and maybe there's a more real state somewhere else. And I also appreciate the caller, John, who talked about that software, the point of view software. It was a great observation of his that it is kind of a metaphor for the way we work. And one of the theories that I like is one called biocentrism, which is Dr. Robert Lanza has written a book on this, and it's not a new idea. It's one that I think a lot of philosophers and early scientists considered. That Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am," and that was hundreds of years ago. People had more of a consciousness-centric point of view of the universe, that what we observe is actually creating our universe. But then we went through a couple hundred years of the Age of Reason and became very reductionist and very logical and scientific, and got to the point where we believed that everything was basically these little billiard balls of matter, and they followed these perfect physical laws, and everything could be explained if you look deep enough into a microscope or deep enough into a telescope. But there's a reawakening of the consciousness-centered idea, and the evidence is all over the place. It's in quantum mechanics experiments. It's in the way the brain works. When you think about how we perceive things, we perceive things differently than animals do, for example. So who's right? Is that wall white or is it green? Does it look the way it does?
One of the things that makes a lot of sense when we think about it, because we're self-aware, and perhaps a dog is, but not a fish, is it somehow we realize that we're somewhat separated from each other, that we have different realities. Two of us can be in the same room and have or on either side of the same kiss and have a completely different experience.
Exactly.
So the reality changes, as you said, biocentrically from individual to individual. But the real awakening comes when somehow we realize, at least in the most esoteric teachings, that we're all connected into some kind of unified consciousness that we individually interpret with our own experience.
Exactly. And I think that, you hit upon the key there. It's fine to say things are consciousness-centric, and it's sort of a philosophical view, but when you realize that we're all connected, what explains that? And the one thing that really does explain it and explains all of the connectedness anomalies is the programmed reality view. Take for example, the entanglement of particles that have been baffling physicists for decades. One particle can be separated from another. Once they're entangled, they can be light years apart, and as soon as one is observed to perform a function, the other one performs the opposite function simultaneously, faster than the speed of light. So, historically, some people have said, well, maybe there's a holographic nature to the universe. Maybe everything's connected on a deeper level, and that connectedness travels instantaneously and isn't encumbered by the speed of light. But that's just another paradigm.
Help us understand what you mean by holographic. What does that mean to our listeners?
There's a book by Michael Talbot called The Holographic Universe, and I really recommend that. It's a great, thoughtful book, and it was based on some work done by physicist David Bohm and others. Basically, the idea is, with a hologram, you have all of the information about the image of the hologram is at every point in the hologram. So if it's on a piece of paper, for example, or on some sort of film, you can cut it in half, and you'll still have the entire image in both halves of the hologram, because it's not, the information that that describes the object is not distributed throughout the hologram. It's actually distributed everywhere, but it's also everywhere at once. It's at every point. The only thing that happens when you cut it in half.
Are you actually cutting down on the resolution of that image? You're saying that a shade of that image is still left if you cut it down?
When you cut it in half, you cut down the resolution a little bit, because everything kind of adds up together. The more you cut it, the more your resolution lowers, but the image, the full image itself is still there. And it's kind of a way of describing reality. It's kind of a way of describing how one particle light years away could know about another particle, because all the information about every particle is everywhere. But it doesn't really explain it that well. It's just, one more idea that you have to come up with an explanation for.
Well, we were talking about particle entanglement theory, and it's really an empirical miracle that guys like Alain Aspect and others played with, and it's now pretty routine. We capture an ion and an ion capture spectrometer, and we hold it there, and we electromagnetically reverse its spin, and then its sister particle reverses its spin instantaneously. We wonder whether they really are two separate particles, or maybe they're the same particle existing in two places at the same time. Mm-hmm. Einstein called it spooky action at a distance, but one thing is for sure. You observe one, the other one responds to the observation. If that's true, which we know that it is because we can experimentally duplicate it, then what could be affecting the particles in our body somewhere else where those particles are responding inside of us?
Yeah, good question. And again, I think the programmed reality model does actually explain this. If you think about how, an extremely advanced program might work that simulates a reality that's as complex as ours, it has to know everything. It has to know the state of all matter, and all matter down to the atomic level, or down to however level deep it is that we're observing it. For example, it doesn't have to, the inside of a tree doesn't have to be modeled until you cut into it. But, it has to know the state of anything that we could observe. And by knowing that in every clock cycle, it could have rules that are followed, such as entanglement rules. Two objects, once entangled, will always perform an opposite function at every clock cycle through the program. It's a very easy thing to program. It doesn't answer the observational question, but if you also consider that this computational device could receive our observational experience and intent, because that's just input data that we're getting, and there's no reason why that couldn't also be connected to this computational mechanism, then it's capable of determining whether or not something's being observed at any time, and it can make the adjustments on the fly. So that whole, that quantum weirdness about, is something could be observed remotely light years away would completely change a spectral pattern or an interference pattern, back here. Those kinds of things that just defy logical explanation are very simple when you think of it in a programmed standpoint.
Well, at what point then does the individual human consciousness realize that he's either acted upon by the universe and this entanglement with all the matter that he can see and not see, or he acts upon the universe?
That's a real good question, and it's one that I don't approach too much in the book. The purpose of the book is really to compile all of the evidence that we do live in a programmed reality. And there's in the book, it focuses basically on four categories of evidence. Since I published it, there have been a lot more things that I could have included that I've discovered. You know, the evidence just piles up. But whether or not we have free will, whether, you know, our actions are actually deterministic and things like that, you know, those are still questions that I think remain unanswered. My feeling is that we do have free will, and that we are somewhere else, a consciousness acting on the environment, and that, you know, the results of our actions are part of what the program interprets and then makes modifications to all the state of the universe effectively.
Well, you made a observation in your book which I like. I tend to call this body that we have that encases our spirit or our soul or whatever you want to call it, I call it the biological transducer. This is loaded with all kinds of sensors and a factory which can turn virtually anything that won't make a billy goat puke into food and keep us alive and living, at least a living system. But sometimes if I'm away from a mirror for a long time, like I'm out working on a contract or something, and I come in and I look in the mirror, I am always surprised because I go, wow, who's that guy? You know, that's not what I feel like. That's not who I am inside. And when I look at me from the outside, all this, what you call the plumbing to which biologists refer to as defining life as a vehicle for the soul, and the soul continues beyond death. That soul that's inside is the real animating force. It's the real identity of us. It's
exactly.
not the biological transducer. Is that deterministic, or is that part of the program as well?
Yeah, I think that was the kind of the question that I was responding to. I thought that's what you meant by, you know, acted upon. That's real hard to determine. I mean, some of the evidence is there have been some experiments that show that the brain responds before, you know, before conscious intent is acknowledged. So it's hard to say whether or not that really implies that there's a cause and effect there and that something else is in control, but we certainly feel like we're in control, and that's what I have to go on. And I provide some examples in the book of ways that you can kind of reduce that, that feeling to a point where you have to, you know, acknowledge that there is something unique about a soul and, you know, the body that it occupies. Because of that, I kind of feel like we could be able to occupy anything. People talk about, well, what happens when we create a sufficiently advanced artificial intelligence? Will it be, you know, alive in the sense that we're alive? Will it really have feelings? Will it have sentience? And, you know, if our soul is able to inhabit something that's sufficiently complex to experience, then why not? Why wouldn't the soul maybe make a conscious decision to occupy that artificial device? What's artificial anyway? You know, just because it's made of silicon rather than carbon, if it's sufficiently complex, it's, you know, just as good of a vehicle to experience as anything else.
Sure. We were talking in our first hour about astronomers who are fairly convinced that they have found evidence of respiration on Titan, even though the oceans and most of the atmosphere is made of methane and not oxygen and carbon dioxide. There are respiration systems that work perfectly fine anaerobically in methane. So who's to say which is the better biological transducer?
Right.
You state in your book in this section, I like it's called Tailgating with Jesus. It's believe me, there's not anything irreverent in this book. It is designed to stimulate your thought processes, and it brings philosophers and scientists and psychologists and even, you know, literary sources together and it's quite entertaining and mind-opening. But you're talking about this thing called the collective belief system. Before we get into the details of that, help us understand, what's a collective belief system?
What I mean by that is just sort of the collective belief that people tend to have. So we have seen some of the same kinds of ideas come out of Edgar Cayce, come out of psychologists. Brian Weiss was one who did a lot of research exploring people's past lives. Sort of stumbled across it as he was treating his patients, and he's written quite a few books about it. Bruce Goldberg and others. Ancient Hindu teachings. From all different kinds of sources, we come up with the same kinds of ideas, which is there's a soul and an afterlife. When you die, you meet with these spirit guides in an astral plane that help you design your next life. You may have a different gender from life to life. People who play roles in your life, occur throughout different lives. All of these things are sort of commonalities in different schools of thought. And so it wasn't like a modern analysis was based on the old ideas. For example, the things that Brian Weiss found when he was interviewing some of the people who had these experiences was that what they were describing were things that they were never taught, things that they had no exposure to, and yet they were virtually identical to these ideas. The same thing with Edgar Cayce. So I call that a collective belief system that is very consistent around the world and throughout time. And you just look at that on the face of it, you have to say, well, there has to be something that explains that, and maybe there's something to it. Is it in our DNA? Is it in our brain function? A lot of biologists think that it has to do with the physiology of the brain. I don't know if I would go that far, but it is definitely a curiosity, and maybe sort of a shadowy hint of what the real reality is like and what, real truth is behind our lives.
Well, I was going to say that, left to ourselves, we have a tendency toward the belief that the soul survives the body and maybe even lives in multiple bodies, human and non-human. Of this world and not of this world. But mostly in our societies, we're not really left to ourselves. We're reared in some kind of village with some kind of village mores and religions and traditions. I don't care if you're a Native American or if you're a Roman Catholic, you're going to be taught some kind of story about where you came from, why you're here, and where you're going. And rebellion against that is often results in ostracism from that society, which I guess is, why we charge out into the wilderness ever so often, because we get sick and tired of what's been taught to us, be it Quaker or Hebrew. We often charge out into the wilderness to try to find freedom of thought and freedom of religion, and certainly lots of wars have been taught about it. So what is the survival of the soul? What is the transcendence? It appears to me, at least, and you can chime in here, that individuals come to this planet or come to life in this life that we call humanity with a vast amount of experience and wisdom built in. And mm-hmm. Some of us come here without a clue. So, there appears to be something to this idea that we pre-existed before we came here.
There is. And I explore that also in the book. I think you probably remember the section about, two twins or two people with the same genetic background, the same upbringing, and, one is given too much money in change at a cash register, and the other one, and that person might give it back, and the other person wouldn't. And they have completely different values, even though they were taught the same things by the same people, and they have basically the same genetic makeup. And these differences in values can be significant. And what explains that? Where does that come from? And I think it does come from, a deeper knowledge base, and maybe past lives, and maybe the simulation that we're living out is just one of many, and our collective experience comes from all of them. Why don't we remember more, though? And the reason I think for that is it would just be overwhelming. You know, we are subject to our hardware, to the brain, the brain's capacity, the speed of processing of the brain. We're subject to our bodies in terms of how we interpret things. So if we were inundated with, imagine if we tried to do a brain dump, not a dump, but the other direction, if we tried to absorb everything that's been put out on the Internet, we could never do it. We'd be so confused that, we wouldn't be able to filter out anything useful because we'd be getting it all at the same time. So we have to have some mechanism for filtering out our past lives, if there are indeed past lives, which I tend to believe there are. We have to have some mechanism for filtering them out, otherwise it would be, monumentally confusing. However, the values seem to stay with us.
Well, I was discussing an experiment that was done, and it was as done as scientifically as it could possibly be done. Triple blind, on several different levels. There was just no way to fake it. Anyway, this was a series of interviews that was done with the medium John Edwards. This is the guy on TV, that talks or at least listens to dead people and tells the living about their recently departed loved ones. And not that I really believe in that, but, I looked at the evidence, I listened to the experiment, and it was pretty interesting. But that wasn't the interesting part about it to me. The question that I asked Dr. Schwartz, is the guy that conducted this study, was, if these people have passed on, and some of them a year or two, they're no longer connected to their brain. They're not connected to that physical body anymore. Why is it that those dearly departed only recount their most recent existence on the planet? Why doesn't the guy come back who is a plumber and an esoteric studier or a student, why doesn't he come back and say, oh yeah, and by the way, I was a bricklayer on the pyramids,
Right.
why don't the dead recount their past lives through guys like John Edwards? That's a good question.
It is a good question. Maybe there is a, the filter is stronger. You filter out the more distant past more than the current. The other issue is comes with the concept of time entirely. One of the collective belief system ideas is that after death, everything is simultaneous. That there really is no time. And in reality, when you look at the consciousness-centric point of view of the universe, there's also no time. Everything we perceive is in the moment. The past is just nothing but recollections that we have, and the future is just some sort of, hazy anticipation of events. So, what is time really?
Well, that's true. If we just want to look at this from an astrophysical point of view, at the speed of light, which there are many studies that support the idea that consciousness is many times faster than the speed of light, time slows down to nothing. I mean, distance turns to nothing. The whole universe goes back to being a perceived singularity. Everything, as Jim says, is in the now. So there is no perception of past or present or future. It's all one. Although there are bright spots and hazy spots in that reality or in that consciousness. Now, the point that I was going to bring to this is that some people tend to come to this world born at a very young age, and they show experience beyond their years. Now, some of this can be in music like Beethoven or Mozart or Liszt. Certainly Liszt was amazing. And others can be in forms of literature or engineering or mathematics. Experience that they did not get in this life because it's not available in this life. They're creating new stuff that isn't available here. They brought it with them. So that kind of supports the idea to me that either there is this master program out there that they're accessing or that's feeding them information and they're able to make it solid and other people aren't. To other people, it's just a bunch of garbled data. Or this idea that they're bringing some kind of past experience with them makes sense.
Yeah, I agree. And you also see that those flashes of, you know, brilliance and, you know, unusual capabilities with people who are mentally disabled, schizophrenia, autism, those are diseases of the brain. So you start to wonder, is there something that goes on that breaks down the filtering capabilities of the brain that allow you to now access this stuff a little bit better? And it could happen with, it could happen naturally, it could happen through an injury, it could happen through ritualistic drumming or dancing, ingesting strange plants and drugs. All those kind of things seem to lead to some of the same experiences too, which is also very interesting.
Well, I don't know, there's a dozen ways I can go here. Let's go into the string theory idea right now. The CERN collider appears to be back up and running, and they're going to be firing ions at one another at near the speed of light, blasting them into one another and watching what comes out. But it's sort of like, seeing what's inside of something by taking it and smashing it on the floor. Yeah, we see all the pieces come apart, but you really want to impress me, build one. Make me a proton out of vibrations in the universe.
Yeah, that would be a very, a very tough order for a physicist to follow. But I agree. I mean, it does seem like, you're asking the question, which came first, the string or the theory? You come up with a theory and then you identify experiments to prove or disprove the theory. And if it proves the theory, then that becomes the norm. That becomes what everybody assumes reality to be like. If the experiments don't prove the theory, then you modify the theory somewhat. And that's sort of the scientific method. But if you think about it, what you're doing is you're building a theory. You're not really necessarily building the foundations of reality or even discovering the foundations of reality. You are working backwards. You're doing experiments to try to infer what it's like, and you continue to build up your theory, and it kind of moves in different directions based on, the latest experiments that were done. One of the things I find wrong with that is, and I have total respect for the scientific method. I was trained in that method. I took lots of physics classes and I actually enjoyed them more than my engineering courses. But one of the things that doesn't fly right there is that different experiments under identical circumstances can sometimes produce different results. As you might expect, based on the, observer-centric point of view that we were talking about before. But there are cases where an experiment in Russia will yield completely different results in the United States, and it seems to be because of the belief system of those experimenters. If that's the case, then all the experimenting in the world isn't going to drive you to the truth. It's just going to drive you to what you think is the truth.
Yeah, and it's difficult to build two CERN colliders with two different belief systems. And we're not going to run it with Jehovah's Witnesses one day and atheists the next day just to see if we get different results.
Exactly. This
observation component, though, is really getting a lot of attention on not just the esoteric level, but on the scientific level. It appears from the ideas that are coming out from guys like, Amit Goswami and others, that there seems to be a consciousness constant that is an integral part of this physical creation, this exchanging energy for matter. the reason I brought up string theory is it's a nice way to explain how things come apart. When we, for instance, look at protons, just the protons by themselves of different elements, from hydrogen down to iron, we notice that there is a descending body weight of those protons. All protons are not created equal. Iron is probably the lightest proton in the periodic chart. And somehow when we get out toward the heavier elements and even nuclides, the protons begin to gain weight again. Maybe it is holographic, the way Jim's mentioning here, because obviously the proton reacts just like an ordinary proton, even though it's a little bit skinnier than the hydrogen proton. All the information is there, just maybe not as high resolution as it is with a helium proton or a hydrogen proton. So that being the case, there has to be a certain recipe of strings that makes energy come together into physical form like this heavy little dense particle called a proton, and the heavier one called a neutron.
Sure, and you know, what do physicists tell us that those particles are is they're just nothing but probability functions until you observe them. Photons,
right.
Electrons, protons, anything is nothing but a probability function unless it's observed. And this has been proven with experiments over and over. Well, think about what that means. What does it mean that something is a probability function? It means that it has a kind of like a matrix, and I don't mean matrix in the movie sense, but a matrix of probabilities that it will be at any point in time or any place in space at any point in time. And what determines that and how is that structured could very easily be structured by a table in a computational mechanism. I could write a function that you know, very simply creates probability functions. It's just data. It's just information. So, yeah, we can break apart a proton and find out that maybe it's composed of strings, and then, you know, what's the next step? You know, it's kind of like the Russian doll. The deeper you look, the deeper you're going to find more things. Maybe protons are different in different particles because they're composed of strings that vibrate slightly differently, or those strings are composed of different things. But, you know, when you get deep enough into it, I suspect that all it is information. And that information is synonymous with the model of reality, which would be something that a program could generate.
Well, I guess the question I have is that once it's observed into reality, for instance, the craftsman receives so many board feet of raw wood, and he planes it, fashions it, glues it, and makes it into a chair. He has observed that solid material into the form of a chair. He puts it in a box, somebody orders it off a catalog, or doesn't order, just walks into a room, slides up next to a table. No one's told him a chair is there, but he certainly sees the chair there, and he sits in exactly the same chair that this craftsman made. Once it's observed into reality by anyone in the matrix, it exists, right?
The definition of exists would be, you know, based on each person's observation, but to that extent, yeah, I would think so. I'll give you an example why I say this. I could, let's take a video game example. I could take a scenario where, say, a massively multiplayer online role-playing game, a lot of people are collaborating together to kill monsters or to form a guild or to do whatever it is they do, and I could generate an object that only a couple of them see, and I could decide that I'm only going to allow certain people to see it, people who have a propensity to see certain things. It would appear in their reality, but it wouldn't appear in anybody else's reality. Now, we have cases of that happening. In the scientific community, they're called anomalons. In the metaphysical community, they're called UFOs and cryptozoology and things like that. Those examples are perfectly explained by a programmed reality model.
Yeah, yeah, I see that exactly. That does, that adds a lot more clarity to it. You know, this observation effect has an effect whether we're awake or whether we are asleep. Just the fact that we're not conscious, we might be not necessarily unconscious, but we're in the subconscious and we are observing things, we can have very dramatic effects on the way things work, on the ideas that we get. I know you're an engineer, I'm an engineer. I don't know about you, but I've built a lot of stuff in my sleep. And wake up, I can't figure out how to put something together or why a program doesn't work, or I'm stuck on some Boolean logic, ladder logic program, and I can't seem to find the loop. I find it in my sleep.
Yeah, I've experienced that too, Brooks. And yeah, I've always just sort of attributed it to the idea that my mind's a little quieter, that it's not as cluttered with input, and so it's able to kind of work on those problems, with a little bit more clarity. But if we are in a programmed reality, you know, sleep is just a state that, you know, we appear to be in, and there's plenty going on during that time from a consciousness standpoint.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you mentioned in your book this thing about of shared dreams. I'll just read out of the book. It says, if this and other reports of mutual dreams are not simply a coincidence, there appear to be only two explanations for it. Either there is a common field of information that both parties are tapping into, or both parties have left conventional reality and traveled to a common alternative one. So
right now,
is there a batch program out there that we're both accessing, or are we both leaving the physical reality and going somewhere real and getting knowledge together?
Really hard to tell. I think that maybe some experiments, you know, and one of the things I would really love to see is a little bit more open-mindedness on the part of real researchers to explore things like that. I mean, I know that people are afraid to touch certain topics because of loss of tenure or, you know, ridicule from their peers. And yet, as I understand it, having spoken to some of these people, they tend to, you know, believe a lot of the same things. You know, if everybody would just say, hey, you know what, let's keep an open mind. We don't know what causes these things. Let's try to devise an experiment to determine, you know, one way or the other what it is. I would love to see that. I can offer an explanation, which is, you know, similar to the way one of these large online role-playing games work. They run on different servers. You could be in an environment in one server with other people, and then you could theoretically jump over to a different server with, a different set of characters, or maybe you and that one person who's having that mutual lucid dream with you does the same thing. I don't mean to imply that our reality is being run by a von Neumann architecture, you know, old-fashioned classical computer. If somebody had the intelligence to create a simulation of our universe down to the level that we're able to look and up to the level we're able to peer out with telescopes, and with the complexity that there is, they're very, very far advanced from us, and their computational mechanisms would be basically unrecognizable to us. So I'm just using kind of current day paradigms to explain some of these things, but you know, the concept makes sense to me if I'm explaining that right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the evidence seems to fall into line to support the concept that obviously, and we say obviously because we make these observations on the outside of results, and the results seem to fall into a category that supports the idea that there really is no difference between the stimulus that's going into the brain and what reality is. You could be sitting in some construct somewhere, not even a physical being, having this physical experience, not unlike not unlike the Matrix. We do have a caller online, Dale from New York. Welcome to the program.
Oh, it's good to be here. Great show tonight.
Thank you very much.
I have a question for your guest, Jim. Now, I'm trying to phrase this to make it make sense, but is our mortal existence possibly to be conscious, is it a requirement to go through a mortal existence? Is that part of the program or a requirement of the program to become more conscious?
Yeah, I mean, real good question, Dale. I don't think it would have to be. You know, of course, that could be the way reality works. But, you know, I suspect, you know, based on some of the things we talked about before, how experience seemed to kind of transcend your life and your current mortal existence, that isn't a requirement. That the consciousness doesn't have to be embodied in a mortal existence. I'm sure you've heard some people explain this like that we are all connected, we are all one with God or the universe, and that it's God's way of experiencing reality, because without sensory inputs, a God or a universe could not experience reality. So, you know, in that way, you kind of view it as tentacles of a greater consciousness. Those are concepts that are kind of beyond the book. They're not something that I explore too much in there, but they would all fit in well with the idea of this programmed reality.
Okay. Well, if that's the case, then wouldn't these negative entities that tend to run the planet and try to drive everybody to the ground be part of this whole program? They serve some kind of function.
Yeah, they could be. I mean,
waking people up.
Sure. So, I actually did an interview last night. We talked about the exact same thing. It's hard to appreciate a positive unless you have a negative to compare it to. So maybe there's a function of the negative energy that its existence defines what a positive energy is like. Maybe that's part of the game. You know, I don't mean to use the word game in a loose sense, but, you know, in the sense of what it is that our purpose is, that we're, you know, the simulation that we're playing. Maybe there's something to overcome, something to, you know, to get past, and these negative entities that you refer to are the, antagonist in the simulation.
Well, we do see in numerous spiritual writings, not the least of which is Buddha, even Jesus, in the Old Testament, Book of Revelations, it talks about beings who overcome everything, who realize, for all intents and purposes, the game is up. There is no temptation left for them, and there's no need for them to be physical anymore. Then they return to heaven or to nirvana or wherever, never to come back because they don't need to come back. But now, there's a strong feeling, and I want to run this by you, Dale, and also Jim, that there are beings on the earth right now who didn't have to come back, who had already conquered everything, every temptation. They had done it. They'd overcome life, living, mortality. And yet they chose to come back anyway. Maybe to help, maybe to... Because I know when people die, one of the regrets that they talk about before they die is leaving things behind. And maybe those who transcend, those who ascend, who are turned into heavenly beings, also regret leaving loved ones behind. So they come back for another mortal life.
Yes, I've heard the same thing. I've also been explained to me by other people that in some way, a lot of us volunteered to come here to do a job. We said, yeah, we'll do that. I'm not even sure what job I'm supposed to be doing, but I'm here like everybody else.
Well, I think that's part of the you know, the same kind of idea we talked about earlier, which is you don't have access to the reasons that you came here. If you did, it might kind of defeat that, if you know what I mean. You know, in other words, you have to on your own overcome something. If you knew the game, then it would be far too easy and kind of pointless.
That would be a little bit like Captain Kirk cheating on the game with the Romulans, but
exactly.
It can be done.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate you guys, and I appreciate your show, Dr. Agnew.
Thank you so much, Dale. Have a fun in New York this week.
Thank you for the call.
You know, we're coming up to the top of the hour, so we have about 6 minutes left in this hour. We'll take a short break and let our affiliates do their thing. I want to cover one of the anomalies when it comes to this idea that, we are a mortal being having a mortal experience as opposed to we are an eternal being having a mortal experience, and that is the idea of the out-of-body experience or remote viewing or this mounting evidence, and I'm sure it's much more well collected now than at any time ever before, and that's the near-death experiences.
Mm-hmm.
You know...
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say they seem to kind of fall in some categories, and I don't think they all get together and coach one another, because near-death experiences are the criteria for those now are getting rather categorized. That is to say, people that have had heart attacks on the operating table, been dead for at least 2 minutes, that's the threshold to get into being an NDE candidate. So it's pretty strict. It's not like, you know, I had some bad Chinese and I felt like I was going to die and now I've got these visions. No, there are certain criteria that go with it. So what is it that opens up the idea that they've sort of peered behind the keyboard of the Matrix during these experiences?
Are you asking why they might do that? Or, you know, I mean, as you've described it, I think it's good evidence that there's something else out there. Especially the cases where, you know, people have completely flatlined, and yet they've described things that are going on during that time when there's absolutely no brain function. It would be impossible for them to otherwise do that. That's very good evidence that a consciousness survives mortal death. But so, are you asking, you know, why? What would be the purpose behind that, or just sort of commenting on the...
Well, is it an anomaly to the program? Is it kind of like, you know, Neo is now realized that he doesn't have to dodge bullets anymore?
I think, just my gut feel, I certainly don't have all the answers to that, but it seems like these are the kind of things that lead us in certain directions. If this didn't happen at all, there might be a lot less exploration, a lot less speculation, a lot less hope, a lot less thought about, consciousness beyond death. So the fact that it does occur once in a while is curious enough for us to pursue that as an avenue of inquiry, and it kind of is what makes this life, the simulation, interesting and worthwhile.
Well, I guess the interesting thing that I see is that the people that I have met that have had NDEs, they've been corroborated by medical evidence. For the most part, they're less religious and more spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
They have a tendency to drop out of their organized method of worship and shall I say dogma, and now they're more awakened, so to speak,
right,
as to what's really going on, and then they come back with a change of purpose, it seems.
Right. Yeah. No. That's that's a very good observation.
Well, we're right at the top of the hour. Let's go ahead and take a quick break. We'll take more of your phone calls at 415-762-1161. My guest tonight is Jim Elvidge, and his book is The Universe Solved. Jim, do you have a website that you want people to go to?
Oh, sure. It's theuniversesolved.com, just as it sounds, no dashes or anything. And that site contains, I've tried to make it pretty interactive, so there are polls people can take, they can respond to things, there's a pretty active forum where people talk about all these ideas, post new experiments, new experiences that they've had. There's even an artificial intelligence called a chatbot that's on there that you can talk to and consider what it means to be alive, artificial or not. So there's a lot of information there, and of course you can order the book there. You can also order it on Amazon.com.
Very cool. Be back in about 3 minutes.
Well,
don't go away.
I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Neil Young's song After the Gold Rush, performed by the Alice Band a cappella. Kind of interesting. I like it. Don't forget that you can pick up your copy of Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. The ebook is available for $7.95. You get 25% off the printed version. We're going to go ahead and throw in the audio version when the printed version comes out. So we will send you a coupon. You'll be able to go back in, order the printed version of the book, and in the receipt for that printed version, you will get the audiobook. So you'll have the ebook, the audio, and the printed version for a whale of a good price. RememberingTheFutureBook.com. RememberingTheFutureBook.com. This is Father's Day, and if you missed our first hour, you might want to go back and listen to that. Our guest tonight is Jim Elvidge, and we're talking about the book, The Universe Solved. His website is TheUniverseSolved.com. And we'll be back in about 40 seconds to talk with more about The Universe Solved with Jim Elvidge. Be right back.
The spice extends to life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital. Spice Life Space Trap.
Something is happening to the human race. It appears that we are evolving, but what is the key to the evolution? What is the event? What is the process that is making this happen? As quoted in the book, The Universe Solved, Jeremy S. Anderson says, there are two major products that came out of Berkeley, LSD and Unix. We don't believe this to be a coincidence. Jim, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Brooks. I take it you like that quote, too. It was always one of my favorites.
Well, I used to be a math instructor in college. I taught algebra and statistics, and I had, you know, a lot of adult students who had trouble with fractions, and they were coming back to school to get their education, and they had to go through this college algebra class. And I told them, listen, there is crying in mathematics, okay? you will get to the point somewhere in this course where you just don't understand it. I'm telling you, stay at it, keep trying the programs, keep following your notes. After you cry, your brain goes through some kind of change that math becomes more fluid to you. It begins to work. I don't know if it's true or not, but I've done plenty of crying with mathematics over the years.
That's
you
great.
Have too with being in physics, memorizing all those blasted formulas and constants.
Absolutely. Brooks, one other thing. I was understanding that this would be 1 hour. I can certainly answer a couple questions, additional questions if you have, but I do have another engagement tonight.
Sure, no problem. No problem at all. We can go another hour on our own. That's not a problem at all. I thought we could stay 2 hours, but if you have another engagement, that's totally cool.
Okay, cool.
I just want to ask the question, you know, the when we alter the reality artificially, it's not just a method of or the result of tuning out. We don't just drop out of reality. Sometimes, because we've tapped into this alternate reality that's away from the peas and carrots and McDonald's of our hubbub life here, we come back with discoveries that elevate the race, either music or computer programs or mathematics or sociological or psychological discoveries. To what do you attribute that?
It seems to me that it's the kind of thing that the, quote, programmers might be injecting into the reality. So, you know, here's a little Easter egg for you. Here's a little something that you can discover that helps elevate your experience or elevate your society's experience. You know, maybe a way of leading us on. You could imagine that we could get into a rut and that the rut could be recognized and, you know, a solution provided, but not in a real obvious way. If it was done in an obvious way, then it would be, you know, the gig is up. It would be very, very clear what's going on, but so it has to be done very subtly, and that seems to be the effect that happens. That brings to mind the question of whether or not the programmer is actively involved, or did the programmer just wind up the clock and put the construct in and allow our consciousnesses to play in the simulation. It does seem a little bit like it might be more the former than the latter.
Well, there is some evidence that there have been many major civilizations that have reached their zenith upon this planet, as advanced as ours, maybe even more advanced than ours, and they're gone. So I'm hoping that the programmer doesn't somewhere in here hit Control-Alt-Delete and start over.
Would we even know it if they did?
Oh, man.
So, okay. I mean, one of the things that always fascinated me was this concept of last Thursdayism. You know, when if we are in some sort of simulation, when did it start? Did it start 13.7 billion years ago when the universe was, as we are told, was formed? Or did it start, you know, at the beginning of human consciousness? Or did it start 5 minutes ago? There's really no way to tell. I mean, you could imagine a scenario where you're in a very advanced entity and you want to play some sort of simulation game, and you snort up a few nanobots and it clears your memory and injects a construct of new memory in your brain, and then you begin your simulation, and then at some point you end it, and you know, maybe it's even timed to last for an hour or timed to last for, you know, a couple days. And, you know, the sense of time could be completely different, too. But you can imagine that all these scenarios might be possible.
My goodness. Well, that sure opens the print to a lot of possibilities. Well, listen, if you have another engagement, we'll let you to it. I've got about another 48 minutes to do here, and I've got callers stacked on the line. So I really appreciate you coming on the program. I thoroughly enjoyed the book, and I've got post-it notes sticking out all over the sides of it. But it stimulated my mind on so many different levels, and I really had to lay the book down a couple times and think about it for a couple days because it really was an eye-opener.
I still do the same thing, Brooks, and I, you know, still discover things all the time. I try to keep up with the research in AI and quantum mechanics, nanotech, and it all plays together so well. And the more I think about things, and the more I research it, the more evidence I see for this. So, you know, again, I really appreciate the opportunity to be on the show. And sorry for the confusion there about the time. Maybe another time we can do a little bit longer.
Sure, no problem. I really appreciate it. I'll let you get to your week and your other engagement. Thank you so much, Jim.
Thank you very much, Brooks.
All right, good night. So I'm going to go ahead and open up the phone lines now. I know a lot of you have been sitting out there listening, 415-762-1161. I have had people tell me on the side before, Brooks, this is all an illusion, you know. This is all just a big hologram, so don't get all uptight about it, okay? If you don't get this built, it's no big deal. Well, I got to tell you, Earth Explorers, I kind of feel like it's a big deal. You and I, we wake up in the middle of the night sweating with our heart pounding out of our chest, worried about whether we're going to make our next house payment or, worried about whether, the love of our life is going to love us tomorrow. That's real to me. I mean, yeah, I might wake up and say, but no, wait, I had the scars. I have the missing finger. I have the missing teeth from that experience. And then it makes you think about it. Do you think those were really teeth in your mouth? Do you think that's really skin that you had there? Yeah, well, we do fall in love with the gravity of this planet. And I use that word gravity very broadly. Because there are a lot of things that pull us from one end to the other that hold us down or that don't hold us down. Sitting around the campfire many times we have discussed, gee, what if we could gather up gravity and we could stick it in an amplifier, reverse its phase, and shove it out the back end? We could go anywhere in the universe. And, you know, trying to make a teenager think about what it means to reverse gravity sometimes is a challenge. But one of the things that might help you keep it in mind, you know when you go to the mall and you see that little funnel in the mall that the kids can't resist? Okay, you can't resist putting a nickel into it, watching it go around and around and around as it gets faster and faster toward the center. That's actually, you know, the mathematic bending of space-time that Einstein talked about. That when you have heavy bodies in space, stars or neutron stars or coalescing neutron stars or even black holes, that's how it warps space-time, sort of like that. And when you let the nickel go, it doesn't just take a straight line right to the bottom of the funnel. It goes around and around and around, and it orbits that center piece like we see the accretion disks do and galaxies do and clusters and superclusters of galaxies in the universe, which means that space-time is just warped and bent every which way that you can think about it, like a quantum foam. Well, what does it look like when you reverse that? And I explain it by saying, well, that's simple. You just take that cone that you found in the mall and you flip it upside down. And this time you drop the quarter from the small end, from the inside. And what happens is it follows the curvature to the outside of that center, of that circle. So, how do you do that? How do you take a force which appears to take anything of any matter, of mass, and attracts everything to it? Our own planet holds something as tiny as an air molecule, two little nitrogen atoms together forming N2, floating in the blackness of space, are somehow held to our planet in a 3 or 4 mile thick blanket. They don't go floating off into space. Does the nitrogen atom or molecule have much mass to it? No, but the Earth does. The Earth has quite a bit of mass relative to that that nitrogen molecule, and it's going to hold it down to the planet. It doesn't leak out into space. So it also holds us down. It also keeps us on the surface of the planet. It keeps the structure of the planet somewhat stable. I mean, it sort of undulates and moves around like a soap bubble that's been poked from the side. And that friction causes the mantle to rub against each other and itself and generate volcanoes and earthquakes and split open the crust and all kinds of stuff like that. Somewhere in there, it could be stable. But from what we see, at least from our standpoint, where we have slowed time down to seconds or hours or days or months or years, the Earth moves very slowly. It makes its cataclysmic decisions on a very long calendar, which is good for the human race because it gives us several thousand years to multiply and increase and learn from lifetime. I was going to say from lifetime to lifetime, but that's making an assumption that we live multiple lifetimes. Somewhere along the line, the race itself gains knowledge that it hands on to the next generation. Now we're at a point where that generation, that race of humankind, has achieved a point of knowledge where we are able to stand upon principles that make sense and that don't fall apart, be they mathematical or musical or philosophical, and we can reach further. We reach further into philosophy. We reach further into music. We reach further into mathematics and into our understanding of one another and how interconnected we are. And now, for the first time, well, in recorded history, maybe they had this as well in other grand civilizations and zeniths of other existences on this planet. But for now, the internet links us all together worldwide. You can sit there at your computer listening live to me while I'm sitting here in front of my microphone. And tomorrow morning, thousands upon thousands of people will come into work. They will put on their headphones, open their laptop, begin their day's work at their computer. And they will open X Squared Radio in the background, and they will listen to this program while they're working on their favorite project. And that's changing the universe, because the subjects that we talk about here open the possibilities, increase the number of quantum possibilities of the futures that you can choose and make for yourself. So instead of sitting there wondering about your own woe and whether or not you're going to have a paycheck or friends or babies or a wife or husband, you can make your future. You can choose from the empowerment that you have been given here, and you can make new decisions, ones that don't trap you in the dogma that would restrict your expansion, your ability to love, your ability to understand and tolerate one another, and even help one another, heal one another. Those are the kinds of things that you would learn here at X Squared Radio and at bbsradio.com. Almost 100 hosts out there from which you could choose any number of teachers, advisors, and lecturers. What we choose to do on this program is bring authors like Jim Elvidge, who's not only an engineer but a programmer and has done a great job of observing and writing and putting together this book, The Universe Solved, which is what we discussed over the last hour. What I want to know is your feelings on it, 415-762-1161. In the first hour, we talked about electric vehicles and this discovery. And believe me, it's just as much of a surprise to me as it is you. And I'm going to say maybe a little bit of disbelief from me on the first. I gave the benefit of the doubt. I thought that there was such a thing as the faith and credit of the United States of America. I thought that there was some credibility to a president who stands up and says, we are going to support electric vehicles and alternative energy. And then I watched John Stewart's program about three nights ago, and he was talking about the same speech that I was talking about from Obama, about how wonderful alternative energy was and how great a thing it's going to be to establish energy independence where we're not dependent upon foreign oil and those countries that do not have our best interests at heart. And both in a humorous manner and in a very intelligent manner, John explained his frustration with it. And he said, wow, that was really a great speech, really talked about some great subjects. If only the last president had said those things and got us started on that path. And then he played a clip from George W. Bush that said almost identical words. And he went, gee, wow, well, maybe we didn't have that. Maybe if the president before him would have said it. And he played President Clinton saying the same thing. And then George Bush saying the same thing. And then Ronald Reagan and on and Ford and all the way back to Carter. Eight presidents, Earth Explorers, eight presidents in a row said exactly the same thing. Alternative energy, wind power, solar power, electric vehicles, biofuels, getting us off of foreign oil and establishing energy independence. Less money today is spent on that than at any time in the last 30 years. And I'm not talking as a portion of the gross national product. I'm talking about real dollars, okay? Yes, there have been grants sent out there, but they haven't been to the manufacturing of electric vehicles. No, they have gone to bail out political supporters decade after decade after decade, hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayers' money has been poured down a rat hole for nothing but big corporate auto and no electric cars. Sure, you see a lot of neat pictures on the internet. Of course, you hear a lot of slick commercials, and you're buying stock in companies like Nissan, who claim to be bringing out vehicles that will get us off of gasoline. But it isn't happening, folks. Those cars are not being built. They're being paraded, but they're not being built. If that's going to happen, it's got to happen from you. It's not going to happen from the government. We have a caller on line one. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Agnew.
Hello. What's on your mind?
I've got a couple. I love that last author that you had on. And I love the observation effect and all the new information that is coming out on it. And it really empowers, I think, people. And it's a good feeling, gives you a really good feeling because you start to realize, you know, that you can affect and change things in your own environment. And it goes way beyond the secret. But one of the things I wanted to ask about the observation effect, and I always thought that was kind of peculiar, what they're basically saying is things are not happening until you observe it, correct?
Well, yes, that's what Jim says. That's what a lot of physicists say, is that things really only exist as a quantum probability until they are observed into reality. That is to say, they're measured with a piece of equipment, they're seen with the human eye, or for that matter, interpreted into reality by an observer.
Okay. So if an event happened right now, and then now it's gone, and it's in the past, is that event in a solid 3D reality? Is it now kind of made real and it stays real? Or once I go on to the next moment in my observations, is that last past observation dissipates and it's not real anymore?
Well, I mean, you're talking about the difference between the baboon in the Disney comic, The Lion King, and whether you have actually taken that energy that you had about that idea and you fashioned something in physical form, like a chair or a car or a piece of art that does exist in physical reality and that you can put in a box and ship to someone and they can experience that reality. I mean, on the one hand, you're saying, well, it doesn't matter, it's in the past. And on the other hand, you're saying, yes, but I did this thing and it exists for all time unless, you know, it gets burned or destroyed somehow.
Right, exactly. So it does exist, and once you collapse it into a reality, you observe it, and let's say by observing something you collapse it into a material form, a 3D form, then it's there for as long as it lasts.
Yeah, I mean, I respect the term collapse because we talk about that in a physics point of view. Things, energy exists in a wave form, like a wave of energy, and it behaves like a wave, and yet when it's observed, it appears as a particle, be it a photon or some other physical particle. But you could look at it a little bit more like a pea. You put in the ground and you pour water on it, and then it bursts into life, breaks through the soil, and now you have this reality that's sitting there that you can eat and live off of. So on the one hand, you've got a thought or an imagination. And believe me, there is a nation of people sitting on their front porch wishing the hell out of stuff. And there are others that are out there swinging a hammer, turning a wrench, or burning a fire and building something. That's a completely different energy.
Okay, so here's an anomaly that, and I'm not sure that he really explained this when you were talking to him in the interview earlier tonight, but if I observe something, then it's there. But if I don't observe something, it's not there. Sort of like, why is it if I'm walking across my kitchen and let's say somebody's pulled out the chair, I didn't observe the chair and I bump into the chair. How is it I can bump into something that I've never... Or let's just say I'm just walking along the street and I bump into a pole. How is it I can bump into something I haven't observed?
That's a very good question.
How does that observation work?
There have been people, very unfortunate example here, but that have been shot. I mean, have been sniped. They had no idea the sniper was even there, but they're dead nonetheless. They didn't observe that bullet, but the point is, and this is what I was trying to make with him, somebody observed that into reality. The person that put that pole there in the concrete on that sidewalk into which you walked observed that pole into reality. You then walked into the same physical space, and lo and behold, the pole's there, whether you personally observed it or not.
Well, what about those circumstances, unusual that they may be, where somebody goes, let's say you're getting ready, a lot of people have been in car accidents, okay, and that's a common thing you can, come up against. And some people, do very extremely well in a car accident where, I mean, the car was just mangled in a mess and they were just totally not touched, not even a bruise. And do you think it could be that they were saying consciously, I'm not going to get hurt in this accident. There's just no way that this accident's going to affect me, even though they're in an accident. I mean, is there something, a conscious influence that they can have where, let's say the bullet doesn't hit the person, goes around them, or, they get somebody like 1,000 bullets get fired on them, and yet they walk away, not one bullet hit them. I mean, there have been unusual circumstances in life, and I'm not talking about 1,000 bullets, but where normally somebody should have been affected by this, and they walk out miraculously with no effects. Was it their consciousness that stopped that reality from happening? Did they observe it differently so that it couldn't happen that way, like what normally would have happened? Do you think that you can do that?
You're asking me for my thoughts, and I would say yes. I would say that the consciousness of the person that's involved in that activity is definitely a factor in the equation. if they add their own fear to it or somehow manifest the disaster turning out the way that it does, it certainly has an effect than a different effect than if they walk into that situation quite positively. I counsel people sometimes who are in very tough times of their life, whether they're getting ready to face final exams or an ass chewing from their boss. I tell them, look, what you need to do is put yourself out in the future a couple of hours after this event. Just do it. Just disconnect yourself from it. Put yourself out in the future a couple of hours and look back at this event. Look back at the final exam. Look back at the meeting with your boss that you've been so dreading, or that conversation with someone, or that challenge that you've got coming up. And then look back at it. Because when we look at things on the front end of things, they tend to look like cliffs. They look like insurmountable mountains, like you're trying to climb a 20-story building that doesn't have a single grab hold on the outside. But once you get past it and you look back, it's like people always say, hindsight is 20/20. That means when you look back on things, you can see things very clearly with all of the hidden things there. So try to do that. Put yourself out in the future. Look back at it as though it's hindsight and see how it turns out. Better yet, see how you react to it. And then go back in and face the dragon.
Okay, now I know that within some of the observation effect experiments, they've actually been able to go back in time and change and change it.
Yes, that's right. In each one of our pasts, we have a quantum possibility, although it's not as broad as the future is, because the future is somewhat always in motion. We've made choices in the past. We have engaged in that past. We've left a ripple in the past, as it were. And it isn't a straight line either. I mean, we're not talking about a one-dimensional or a two-dimensional plane here. We're talking about a small series of three-dimensional possibilities, maybe even four-dimensional possibilities. There are some things that you can change in the past. Now, obviously, you can't put your finger back on if you cut it off with a saw, and you can't change the house that burned down, but you can change the way you react to it. You can change the basis of the reality by going back in and reobserving those events. And believe me, they do change. And when you change those events in the past, you then change your present, which is the future, to those past events. And now you have a different launching pad and a whole lot different prejudice on what you can and cannot do for your future.
Well, when you're discussing and looking at materials like this, what would you like to see them? I mean, what sciences do you see coming up that are going to be, like, I can see where the physics has started working hard, and the physicists are coming out with some pretty amazing information now. But as far as other sciences like biology, genetics, things like that, do you see anything forward-thinking doctors in those fields that are starting to do some experiments and work with that will change and alter the way we used to think about it?
Yeah, well, we actually have an author coming up in a few weeks, author of a book called The Happiness Genes, and he discusses this in a lot more detail. We also have Dr. Bruce Lipton that's been on this program before. We're trying to get him back on with his new book. There's a lot of evidence that the human consciousness is part of the formula in the biochemistry of the way genes fold and unfold proteins. Each gene in the human body is responsible for making a broad variety of proteins, and there's even a broader choice of proteins that those genes can make. And we find now that it is not just genetics that determines that folding and unfolding and mutation of those proteins. Largely, it is the environment that the being is in. And I don't mean just the water that they take in, the amount of sunlight they're exposed to, how much they eat or drink or smoke or anything else like that. I'm also talking about the environment in which the human consciousness bathes those genes in that energy. And not just yours, but the consciousness of the beings around whom you live and work also affect those genetics. There's very, very conclusive evidence, not just in humans, but in other animals, mammals and other animals, that the behavior patterns of the parents after the pups are born has an effect on those pups generations out for their ability to fight disease, for their ability to adapt to environmental changes, and for their ability to make very progressive socioeconomic movements, which means the human race is evolving, and it's evolving at an accelerating rate because of the awareness of the human consciousness.
Well, I was always taught in school that you are your genes. In other words, so if you got this genetics, if your parents had this genetics and they had cancer or Alzheimer's, well, then you had to worry about the hereditary factors in the genes. This sounds like that isn't the case.
Well, for the large part, it is. If your parents had a propensity toward diabetes, you have a propensity for diabetes. Now, whether or not you develop that, it, as it turns out, is a function of your consciousness. And it's also a function of your consciousness whether or not your children inherit diabetes from you. Now, I know that sounds kind of crazy, but it is absolutely true. We can take rats who are perfectly healthy, and we can give them drugs that make their pancreas malfunction, and the rat develops diabetes. Now, this is after the rat's born. Its genetics are determined. It's done. Then that rat has progeny. It has pups. Those pups will develop diabetes, as though the parent rats had genetic diabetes. That is amazing.
So your environment is involved. How much of it is environment? Well, as far as nurture and nurture, how much is influencing the genes? And you're saying that the genes that I'm born with, I can, before I die, I can change those genes.
Well, in answer to your questions, it's 31.62%. I'm kidding. I nobody knows the exact percentage. but I can tell you that, you know, there is a cumulative force that is applied to the genetics by the being that's occupying the body at the time. Now, I would say that if you had a propensity toward diabetes or Alzheimer's or cancer, for that matter, that you could consciously change your diet. You could move away from red meat and cigarettes and lots of alcohol to a lifestyle full of vegetables and exercise, and you could probably change your total biochemistry. And believe me, you can change your biochemistry by drinking a glass of water. You could change your whole biochemistry and your consciousness, and chances are very good that you would never develop those diseases. And better yet, you wouldn't pass them on to your children.
Well, thank you, Dr. Eckner. I really appreciate you spending all this time with me and answering all these questions. I'll get off the air and allow some other callers in. I'm sure there's other questions that need to be answered before the show ends tonight.
I appreciate the observation. He was a really good interview, wasn't he?
Yeah, he really was terrific. I'm going to run out and get his book now. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye. Thanks for calling. Bye-bye. Well, Earth Explorers, we have about 20 minutes, 18, 19 minutes. I'm going to go ahead and keep the phone lines open, 415-762-1161. In the coming weeks, July 1st, we'll be heading up to Trout Lake, Washington for the ECETI, ECETI.org, if you're interested in joining us. If you have not attended a conference before, I would highly recommend this one as your first one. You're going to meet some of the best speakers and minds, and I'm talking very settled individuals, very well-researched Egyptologists and psychologists and investigators, scientists. This is really the best conference in the country that I can think of for things that are enlightening and uplifting and mind-expanding to give you hope that there is a chance we're all going to get out of this alive. How to get there is you go to ECETI.org, ECETI.org, or you can click on the link at xsquaredradio.com and register. Now, there are, believe me, you can afford to go. The budgets are there. If you're in the Northwest, you have no excuse not to drive up there, at least for one day of this conference. I speak on Friday. We have William Henry, who's going to speak on Sunday. We've got Michal Ledwith, tremendous John Riley with Zero Point Research is going to be speaking to us this year. Lots and lots of great scientific minds up there. And if you've never seen a UFO, daytime or nighttime, either one, you need to make your way up there. This is a real hot spot. And when we get a few hundred people together up there on what is affectionately called the ranch at the base of Mount Adams, the consciousness is such that in those few days, you're not going to have a workshop high. You're going to have a life-changing event. And we encourage you to make your way up there. Besides, it's hotter than blue blazes everywhere else in the country. And it's going to be nice and cool up there in the evenings. Make sure you bring a jacket and something warm to wear on your hands, because it can get rather frosty up there at night. Bring a tent. Camp out. You're going to have a wonderful time. We encourage you to make it. Also, don't forget that Remembering the Future, the ebook, is out right now for $7.95. You go to rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com. Once you get the ebook, you're going to receive, when the printed version comes out, you'll receive a 25% off coupon so that you can order the printed version of the book at 25% off. You'll get that autographed. And I am working on the audiobook right now, and I will send you the audio version as well. So that's a heck of a deal. You get to read it now. You'll get 25% off the printed version, and you'll get the audio version that you can pack around in your car and listen to and share with friends. It is at the printer right now. We're waiting for our galley copy. As soon as the galley copy comes in, if that looks good to me, I'm going to sign off on it. It's going to go into production, and then we'll be out on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books a Jillion, and everywhere else. So that's rememberingthefuturebook.com. Also, those of you listening around the world, you know that 2012 is coming. People have so many questions about this. Oh, my goodness. When we started writing our books in 2001, maybe three books on the shelves on 2012, and they were old at that. Now there are 500 or 600 different books out there on 2012. Everybody's talking about it. But the critics say that the Arc of Millions of Years, the series, there are three books in the series. The first one is called New Discoveries in Light on the Creation. The second one is called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times. And the third one is affectionately called Unlocking the Secret. It's about 1,500 pages between these three books. The critics say they are the most comprehensive work ever written on the 2012 phenomenon. You're going to get almost 400 pictures between those three books. Now, those of you that have published books, bought books recently, you're going to get a book with maybe 9 or 10 pictures or drawings in it. The last book has 189 pictures in it. So lots and lots of information there. You can travel all over the world and find this stuff out for yourself. We did it for you, and you're going to have a wealth of information at your fingertips. The Ark of Millions of Years is the name of the book. The website is arkofmillionsofyears.com. Diane in Michigan, welcome to the program. How are you? I have a caller on line one, Diane from Michigan. Are you there? Okay, I'm waiting for her volume to come up. I'm sure she can hear every word I'm saying. Okay, she may pop back in. Looks like she had to go, but she may come back in. Anyway, we want you to get these books in your hands for the summer. We want you to come up to the eSETI conference on July 1st through the 4th. You're going to have a great time. I would love to meet you. Bring your copies of the book, and I'll be happy to sign them when you get there. We have about 9 minutes or so, 8 minutes. The number here is 415-762-1161. Diane, if you're out there in Michigan, you can call me back. Be happy to talk to you. Our guest tonight in the second hour was Jim Elvidge. And his book was The Universe Solved. His website is theuniversesolved.com. And, you know, there are a lot of people out there who have made the case, none so eloquently as Jim, that there is a matrix. Now, there have been individuals that have written on the matrix, certainly movies written on the matrix. But the idea that we are part of it, can transcend it, and get some kind of knowledge about it is what really makes this book great. Okay, Diane is back. Welcome to the program, Diane.
Hi, Brooks. How are you?
I am doing wonderful.
You? I know you are. The program was great. I just wish you would have been on longer. But I wanted to tell you, you were advertising for East City Ranch for James Gilliland. And it's sold out. It is completely sold out. Everybody got an email on the fact that it was sold out. I met you at eSETI Ranch in 2008, and I will be there this year. I couldn't make it last year, but this year I will be there. We're driving across the country from Michigan. Across the country, first time ever, because I will not get on a plane.
I'm in Detroit
and through Portland. I will not go through the x-ray machines and all. I've already been put through that so many times. I said, this time I'm driving and I will experience the United States through car.
Well, you're going to enjoy it, especially across.
Oh, I know I'm going to enjoy it. You're going to be there.
Yeah. Well, Montana's awesome. I mean, if you're driving from Michigan across that way, you're going to go through Montana.
Oh yeah, we're going to go the southern route going and coming back. We're going the northern route.
Oh my goodness, you're going to have a wonderful time. You're going to go.
I'm looking so forward to it. But Jay, the ranch itself, the things that transpire there. I mean, when you step foot on the ground, you just feel an energy that is just unbelievable. And
well,
my first time there was 2008, and it was just, and I camped there. This time I'm staying at the Serenity. I won't be camping there, but I'll be staying at the Serenity, which is just down the not too far away. And, they didn't have that available to us in 2008, but it's available to us now. But
awesome.
I can't wait to meet you. I hope you have your new book there.
Well, it's not in print yet. The publisher has been so slow this time. It's been months and months.
You know what? You got to fire the publisher.
Well, I fired my last publisher because they were first. And I got with this next one, and I thought we were doing okay. And then, believe it or not, in the course of the 3 months that we've been processing this book, two of the book counselors have both been fired. So now I'm on my third one.
You know, when you said that 3 months ago, and I said, I know he's going to have the book by the conference. I know by the Transformational Conference, he'll have that book right there on the table that I can buy that book, and then you just announced today that it's going to be another 5 more weeks. And I said it's not going to make it.
I know. It's very frustrating to me.
How disappointing.
We started in plenty of time. We paid him in advance, and that's just the nature of the way people do business these days.
I guess. But anyways, I just want to let everybody know that I can't wait to get there, and I'm so glad. You know, I waited to sign up. I was kind of like, postulating, what I was going to pay for to go to East City. And then
yes.
2 weeks, well, 10 days, that's when James came out with We Are Sold Out.
Wow.
So that
wow.
came through that was, day before
really
yesterday, amazing. So it is sold out. Well, you know, the Sanctuary, I don't know how many people the Sanctuary holds, but maybe it's, what, 250 people?
I have seen 300 in there, and it's
okay.
pretty
Okay, well, then it's sold out over 300.
Wow.
Because, you know, the campground is totally open. It doesn't
sure.
matter how many campers come in there. It's the Sanctuary.
We're just going to have to move outside onto the
We're
stage.
We're going to have to do, yeah, absolutely. We have to expand the Sanctuary. Anyway,
well,
that's all I wanted to call. Thank you very much, Brooks, and I can't wait to see you in a week and a half.
All right. Thanks, Diane. Look forward to seeing you. Drive safely.
Oh, I certainly will.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, there you have it, Earth Explorers. We have about a minute and a half. We can squeeze one more phone call in if you want. 415-762-1161. There are some amazing awakenings going on in the world right now. And it's, I really feel that the human race is evolving in this manner because we can communicate and we can team up and we can group up and we can touch base with one another in intimate ways around the world. We can share pictures and video and voice. We can share our thoughts in writing. We can express ourselves on Facebook and Twitter and email. And we have Skype and Vonage, all kinds of low-cost ways that we can talk to one another in China and India. And now we have listeners in Prague that are ordering the book. X-Squared Radio is one of the most popular programs in Wales, believe it or not. This is the kind of influence that we have on the planet. And the awakening, the changing of the human race, is evident by selling out of the ESETI conference. I don't think that's ever happened before. And I've seen, 300, 400, 500 people there, but to say that you can't fit any more people in there is really amazing that it has grown in awareness and consciousness that much. We appreciate you being part of X Squared Radio all these years. And please, if your subscription has expired, please go back to xsquaredradio.com and sign up again because we have to keep the lights on at BBS Radio. So believe me, I know you guys are out there. Go ahead and sign back up again. $20 a year. It's less than the price of a cup of coffee per month. We have hundreds and hundreds of hours of quality interviews that you can listen to your heart's content. Please help us out. Spread the word. And we We'll see you next week. We'll be in a week and a half, we'll be broadcasting live from ESETI. Who knows who we're going to interview there. Thank you very much for being part of the program. We'll see you next week. Good night. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.